It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin high school student wrote a fairy tale about a century ago inspired by the local landscape. We'll talk to an illustrator who worked on a new book that brings that story to life. First, Canada is citing nearly 200 alleged trade violations against the United States in a complaint it's bringing before the World Trade Organization. Among the concerns are issues with tariffs and the way the U.S. sells some of its goods in other countries. The United States has challenged those accusations. U.S. trade officials have said that the complaint would overall benefit China. Mark Koplovich is with us. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
All right. In a nutshell, what is Canada saying here?
So Canada has brought a case against the U.S. and the World Trade Organization. One of the things the WTO broadly moves countries towards negotiated reductions in trade barriers, tariffs and quotas. One of the things you're allowed to do is put up barriers to trade for certain reasons, having to do with things like anti-dumping, which is a country selling goods overseas for a lower price than they would at home, or countervailing duties, which are to offset illegal subsidies. And so Canada is effectively alleging that the process by which the U.S. does that is illegal, and that they have imposed various barriers to trade, not just for Canada, but across a whole swath of major economies.
And this seems like a weird thing. Usually a country is going to come in and say, we are the aggrieved party here. It seems like Canada's saying we and lots of other countries are being hurt by this. And by the way, other countries maybe join in with us here.
Yes. So often, you know, most often a case in the WTO will be about a certain sector, a certain industry, and it'll be a bilateral dispute. Canada here, they've listed 25 pages of violations, as you said, against the European Union, Japan, Italy, Brazil, Korea, China, etc. And they're alleging basically that the process, that the U.S. is imposing duties that are too high, that they're improperly calculating rates, that they're doing this retroactively. And so it's really a broadside against U.S. trade policy broadly.
And candidate Donald Trump obviously was very vocal about NAFTA and a lot of international trade agreements. What Canada is alleging, is this stuff that has happened since Donald Trump became president, or does this go back before that?
So there's been an increase. There's been about a 50% increase. Canada, the United States, the industrialized countries all use these anti-dumping and countervailing duties. The Trump administration has been doing it more. But more broadly, Canada is doing this in reaction to the Trump administration's general opposition to international trade and its general opposition to trade institutions like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization.
Yeah, this all comes as this renegotiation process is going on with NAFTA. We're hearing even today from White House officials, we're going to renegotiate this thing significantly or we're going to bail, as has been threatened before. Is that that looming renegotiation part of what Canada is looking at here? How does that all interact?
Yeah, I think it's a strategic move on the part of the Canadian government. The Trump administration has been threatening to withdraw from NAFTA. There are negotiations starting in next week in Montreal, a new round with Canada and Mexico. And one of the things that the Trump administration wants to do in those negotiations is get rid of the court in NAFTA, which adjudicates disputes between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico on these types of duties. And so I think the Canadian government is hedging their bets a little bit, saying we're going to now move through the multilateral trade regime in the World Trade Organization and bring in other countries as well and hedge against the fact that the U.S. may be engaging in more protectionist policies in the future.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, looking at a complaint brought by Canada against the United States at the World Trade Organization. What can the WTO, the World Trade Organization, do with a complaint like this?
So when something like this happens, the U.S. now has 60 days to try and settle the complaint. If they don't, then it will go through the WTO's court system. And if they would lose, then the U.S. either has to change its policies, or the countries that are involved, other countries can actually sign on as parties to this dispute now, they would be able to impose retaliatory measures against the United States. But I think broadly, you know, the contents of the dispute are important, but more broadly, this is part of the countries of the world, the major economies of the world, trying to figure out how to move forward with international trade cooperation in the absence of U.S. leadership.
I want to get into that wider issue in just a moment. I want to narrow it down a little bit to Wisconsin. Do we have products, industries at stake here?
We do. So actually, Canada is Wisconsin's largest trading partner, over 30% of our exports, and 52% of our agricultural exports go to Canada and Mexico. So you can imagine if NAFTA suddenly disappears or is renegotiated, and we go back to the days before the 1990s with higher trade barriers, the data I've seen suggests that we could see 20 to 60% higher tariffs on dairy products, for example. The other thing is that manufacturing firms in North America now produce in all three economies because they've treated it as a single market. So you have exporters that are also importing inputs of production from Canada and Mexico.
And now to the bigger picture issues you were talking about there. There seem to be two attitudes toward trade generally. One, trade is overall a good to all parties who sign on. Yeah, there are short-term winners and losers. One country might do a little better today. One sector might do a little worse tomorrow. But overall, we're all doing better because we're trading more freely. Mm-hmm. The other one looks at it as more of a zero-sum game. If you're winning, I must be losing. And it seems like the United States, I mean, that's basically how President Trump has expressed it. What changes when the United States switches from that one concept to the other?
Yeah. So, you know, fundamentally, since the days of Adam Smith, we think about trade increases aggregate welfare, both nationally and the world, but it has these winners and losers and distributional consequences. The way Donald Trump thinks about trade is a very historical way in mercantilist ways where we think about winners and losers, and it's all zero sum. And the problem with that is the U.S. has been the centerpiece since 1947 of the international trade regime, where we have set up rules and institutions to move towards free trade. And countries are very worried now that the U.S. is abdicating that role. And the U.S., the Europeans, the Japanese, the Canadians are thinking about their own regional trade agreements and, you know, pushing forward in a world where the U.S. maybe is not as pro-free trade as it has been in the past.
Is it possible that if the United States withdraws more from international trade that, as you say, other countries will look to enhance their deals with each other? We could be long-term losers if that happens?
I think so, yeah. I mean, definitely in terms of growth and wealth in the United States, withdrawing from the international trade system is going to have short-term and medium-term costs. The longer-term cost is if we re-engage down the line, you have the Canadians and the EU have just signed a free trade agreement. The EU and Japan are negotiating a free trade agreement. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is moving forward without the U.S. now. If and when the U.S. re-engages down the line, we are engaging with institutions and agreements that we were not at the table negotiating. And the U.S., as the most powerful, you know, country in the world, has more or less gotten what we've wanted out of the negotiations of past trade agreements.
But people look at this and say, okay, yeah, there are in certain sectors and places people who lose out, including here in the United States, industries that have been hurt and workers who have been displaced by the trade agreements we've signed in the past.
Yes, of course. And that's the fundamental trade-off with international trade is you don't get the increases in aggregate welfare, you know, for the country as a whole and for consumers in terms of products, lower priced products, without the distributional consequences of certain sectors and firms are winners and losers. That leads to interesting political debates about policies to compensate those who are materially hurt by international trade. But what we do know is that backing out of trade agreements and withdrawing from international trade over the long run leaves countries poorer.
Briefly, I've seen people argue that the big mistake the U.S. made is in not doing enough to help workers in particular displaced by trade agreements. That's where a lot of things went south here.
Yeah, I think trade is often a bogeyman for the state of the economy, but also, you know, the logic of free trade is also predicated on policies to compensate those who do not benefit. And those are often politically the most sensitive. And they're the ones over the last three decades now that the U.S. has really done the least to implement.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at a trade dispute filed by Canada against the U.S. in the World Trade Organization. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW professor whose steampunk-influenced illustrations found their way into a new book inspired by a local Menominee folktale. Stay with us here on Central Time. First, over 100 years ago, a high school student in Menominee, Wisconsin, wrote a fairy tale set in a local canyon-shaped park and then submitted it to her school's literary magazine. That century-old story has been resurrected in a new book called The Devil's Punch Bowl. It features steampunk-influenced illustrations by a UW Stout professor. That illustrator joins us now along with his wife, whose musical compositions also inspired the project. Eric Evanson is an assistant professor of design at UW Stout and illustrator of The Devil's Punch Bowl. And Eric Asfano is a composer, band director, and music faculty at Augsburg University. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Erica, welcome to the show.
Hello.
And Eric, let's start off with some backstory on this local folktale related to The Devil's Punch Bowl.
Sure. The story is was written in 1913 and published in the Menominee High School literary magazine, the Menomite, which I think only existed during this one year. The story is about a princess who essentially gets spirited away by a fairy, and the only way that she can be saved from her sort of like spiritual plight is to have some magic potion from a giant's punch bowl dashed in her face, and then spell is broken.
And was this somehow connected to a folk tale in the area, or was this a complete literary composition?
You know, as far as we can tell, it's a complete literary invention, but it definitely plays on tropes of fairy tales and myths of the era.
And Erica, can you tell us about the place now, this park in Menominee, the Devil's Punch Bowl? What's it like? Do people spend a lot of time there?
Yeah, it's a beautiful place if you're going to come visit Menominee to stop by. It's a geological formation that's due to the glaciers that came through. There's a waterfall and sort of an indentation into the ground. And you can go down some steps and spend some time in this, like, it's basically a bowl in the ground. There's a lot of beautiful nature, and it's a really neat place to come visit when you're in Menominee.
And Erica, is it the kind of setting that might inspire a fairy tale?
It absolutely is. There's this beautiful waterfall, which in the winter is actually freezes over, and so that actually makes it kind of more magical during that time of year. And there's beautiful trees and things around, and you can definitely imagine fairies or gnomes picking out of various places when you're visiting.
And Eric, the author we're talking about, did imagine a tale taking place in this magical environment. Tell us about the young author of this, what is it, almost century-old story now.
Yeah, we actually don't know all that much about her. The story was discovered by Sophie Doan at the Dunn County Historical Society. And it was written by Isabel Waterman. She's Menominee High School class of 1915, I think. And so I think she would have been in 10th grade when she wrote it. Aside from that, and aside from her yearbook entry, we actually don't know that much about her. I believe the Historical Society looked into her background, and I think they discovered that she had a daughter that became a writer in the Madison area. But I don't know her name, unfortunately, and I don't know anything else about the rest of her family. But she definitely seemed like a really interesting kid, and unfortunately, she passed away before I was even born.
I want to throw out to our listeners, give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you can help us pick up the thread of that story. Eric, what led you to want to take the story, I understand, very lightly edit it, but then illustrate it?
Yeah, so actually, a friend of mine at the Historical Society was talking about what a cool project it would be for possibly for students. And I teach at UW Stout, but I don't teach a class that really would cover this kind of project. And so I was kind of talking about how unfortunate it was that couldn't work that way. But I got more and more intrigued the more I talked about it, and eventually just volunteered to do it myself. I'm a huge fan of mythology and folklore. I've published a couple of graphic novels on the subject, and basically, anytime you get evil fairies or giants or princesses involved, I'm usually on board.
And you're an illustrator yourself, right?
Yeah. I'm an illustrator. I'm a graphic designer, and I've done a bunch of comic book work too. So kind of anything in that vein has sort of been in my area.
And I want to get into the style of the illustrations, because you took this in an interesting direction. And I'm going to start by turning to what I understand is your inspiration, and that's you, Erica. You are a composer, and you've written a series of suites of steampunk music. Can you talk about your music?
Sure. Well, I think my influence on this particular Devil's Punch Bowl project was sort of just a matter of timing. I'd written a piece for a concert band that had kind of recently been finished when this project came up for Eric, called Steampunk Suite. It's a four-movement piece that takes sort of twists some important people that were alive in the Victorian era and sort of puts them in a fictional type of setting. And so some of those people include P.T. Barnum, Nikola Tesla, Charles Ives, Marie Curie, and sort of flips, gives them kind of an alternate fictional history and what that might sound like when it's interpreted musically.
I want to give a listen to, I think this is the fourth movement. This refers to a couple of the people you mentioned. Barnum and Tesla's Tandem Bicycle, performed here by the Ohio State University Wind Symphony. Here's a listen. Eric, you've got a soundtrack in your mind. You've got this story, again, by a high school student from a century ago. So how does this feed into your illustrations?
Well, I was kind of lamenting. I had taken on this project, and I think I was looking at some... I started the project by looking at some old illustration work by... people like Arthur Rackham, who's one of my absolute favorite illustrators, and other illustrators from what they call the Golden Age of Illustration, sort of about the same time frame as the Devil's Punch Bowl story. And I was also sort of lamenting that that I couldn't quite find the hook for it. Like, I really liked that sort of older style, but I didn't know how to update it for the modern era, I guess. And sort of... A secondary thought I had that was completely unrelated was I was a little bit jealous that Erica got to work with such a cool subject matter like steampunk. And then our friend, the contact at Dunn County Historical Society, said, well, why don't you just sort of make the story steampunk? And I said, that's it. And so, listening to Erica's pieces over and over again, which I had done at that point, really kind of fueled the fire in terms of putting that stylistic spin on it.
Erica, did you know your music was going to be an inspiration for the illustrations?
Absolutely not. but Eric is always such an inspiration to me anyway, so I'm glad we could be the other way around this time.
Yeah, I wonder, you're obviously a very creative household here with music and illustration. Do you directly, or maybe even just bouncing ideas off of each other, do you find yourself, Erica, giving ideas, inspiring each other one way or another?
Absolutely. We've collaborated on a couple of things, and we have ideas for collaborations going forward. And I will often have Eric listen to something that I'm working on, and he'll often, I think, have me take a look at whatever he's working on, and we ask each other a lot of questions. And even though we're not formally trained in each other's areas, it's we are brutally honest with each other, so that's actually very helpful in the creative process.
And Eric, now you have your book. It's your standard, Northern United States small town fairy tale steampunk illustration book, right? That's a kind of a unique thing, actually. What's been the local response there?
You know, it's been pretty positive. We had sort of a book launch and opening reception for it, where we actually took a small gallery space in the Historical Society and essentially crafted a little gallery corner. We have large printouts of the illustrations, large prints of the illustrations, framed in period frames, hanging on the walls, and we have a bunch of artifacts from the time period that point to some of the artifacts in the story kind of on display with it. So we had kind of this fun evening reception that was pretty heavily attended. I signed books. People kind of looked around the museum a bit. And generally, it's been selling really well. I think we had to go into our second print run already. People have been really, really positive about it.
And Eric, I think when it comes to local history, some people are really into it, and some people really don't think about it, have no clue that it's out there in some ways. Do you see this as maybe a creative way to get people looking back at the past of their local community?
Hopefully so. I think Menominee, in general, is a little bit more... goes a little bit more in depth with their local history. It's partly due to the fact that it is so rich with the lumber industry and the fur trade, and I think people really respond well to it here. So I think it's a pretty receptive community in general. Hopefully it just keeps that ball rolling, I guess.
And Erica, your music helped inspire Eric's illustrations. Are you looking at this story and maybe there's a new composition in there somewhere?
Yeah, it's very possible. So I also am a big fan of fairy tales and storytelling through music. So it's definitely possible.
And maybe the next up could be an animation of this with a soundtrack by Erica.
Yeah, maybe. You know, I've collaborated with some composers in the past on exactly that kind of project, and we do have ideas for one in the future moving forward.
All right, well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Eric Evanson is an assistant professor of design at UW-Stout and the illustrator of The Devil's Punch Bowl. Erica Svano is a band director and music faculty at Augsburg University. We've been talking about The Devil's Punch Bowl, a new book inspired by a local Menominee high school student's folktale from a century ago. You can see some of Eric's illustrations from the book on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stick around, there's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. First, local control has been a hot-button issue in Wisconsin, particularly under the Walker administration. Democrats have said that Republican leadership is chipping away at the power local governments have to make decisions about labor, education, and the environment. Republicans have responded by saying they're interested in saving taxpayers money, something Governor Walker called the ultimate form of local control. We invited two state lawmakers to share their thoughts on the idea of local control and how it plays out in Wisconsin. Diane Hesselbein is a Democrat representing the 79th Assembly District, which includes Middleton and Wanakee. And Rob Hutton is a Republican representing the 13th Assembly District, which includes Brookfield. They joined us earlier today. Representative Hutton, as a general principle, before we dig into particular issue areas, where do we draw the line when it comes to state government overriding local governments? What's your basic philosophy there?
Yeah, it's a great question, and Rob, thanks again for having us on, and I know Rosa Hesselbein and I have probably some similar areas in this discussion and probably some areas that we differ on, but it becomes one of part philosophical in terms of, number one, how do you define local control, and I think that's probably, definitions are always important when we try to speak into them, so how do you define local control, and then philosophically, how do you use that filter of local control when you're making policy decisions that have ramifications both locally as well as at the state level? I think the best way that I do that is simply to say, if there are issues that are isolated to local municipalities in this case or local units of government that don't have any ramifications on a broader level, those to me are pretty clearly local issues that should be left to locals to decide. Issues that locals are involved in and locals drive the discussion with, but can have broader implications outside of that local unit of government. Again, whether that's schools or whether that's a local municipality or whether that's even county, then I think that's when we become a little bit more gray in deciding if local decisions have broader impact, then I think there's a logical discussion and argument to be made for, is there an area for the state to play a role in terms of either guiding, directing, or statutorily requiring state oversight for those? And again, pretty complex filter. It's often a partisan but also a bipartisan issue depending on what that issue is. And so I think we have to go through those issues one by one and carefully to make sure we understand what the ramifications are for the locals, what the ramifications are for a broader level of government.
And I want to jump in, Representative Hunt, and bring in
means long term.
I want to bring in Representative Hesselbein. And again, before we get into particular issues, do you have an overriding principle, Representative Hesselbein, when it comes to local control versus state government overrides?
I definitely have very strong opinions about local control. You know, since taking power in 2010, Republicans have passed more than 124 changes to state law that take away authority from local governments. As a former Dane County board member and as a former school board member for the Middleton Cross Plains Area School District, I think that most decisions that people make on the local level are extremely important, and that Republicans used to be the party of local control, but now they are the party of complete control, and I disagree with that.
And Representative Hutton, let's get into a particular issue. You've worked on some things related to labor, barring local governments from requiring, for example, that contractors reach a project labor agreement with unions on publicly funded projects. Talk about how that fits into local control. Why is that something that local governments shouldn't have the flexibility to set for themselves?
Sure, and I think that's a great case in point. I think that goes back into, again, the filter of, are there decisions being made by local units of government that can have a statewide impact? And that certainly, in my mind, would be the case for project labor agreements, because while it has been the purview of a local unit of government to set the dictates for how a private sector contractor has to function for a publicly funded project within that municipality, the ramifications of that don't just impact that local municipality. The impacts of that are seen both within the private sector with private sector construction firms, both those that reside within that municipality and those that reside around the state that would otherwise be well qualified and well deserving of participating in those projects. But because of decisions made by a local unit of government, there are employers and significant numbers of employees that are negatively impacted because they are boxed out of even the RFP process, not to mention the awards that go with those RFPs to perform projects and to receive the work on an hourly basis to perform those projects. And so we look at those and say, we think policy that has the possibility of implicating greater negative impact for not just issues within that local municipality, but for individuals and, in this case, contractors on a statewide basis, need to be limited and need to be prevented, because all individuals who have the ability to participate in that type of project deserve the right to do so.
And Representative Hesselbein, what's wrong with that? If a local government's decision is hurting businesses around the state, distorting the labor market in effect, should the state step in?
This is just another long line of attack against workers. And the evidence shows that public labor agreements utilized in Wisconsin have had all the desired impacts on time, on budget, safety, hiring preferences for veterans, which Representative Houghton knows is extremely important to me, you know, often with local hiring preferences, so that for these projects you are hiring your hardworking neighbors, not people from out of state, and providing good family-supporting wages and benefits, both on public and private projects. Public labor agreements have built things from construction on Disney World to Northwestern Mutual's new tower, Toyota plants across the country, and even Lambeau Field. And if successful, cost-efficient businesses use public labor agreements, local government should at least have the option to consider it. It's very important for the state of Wisconsin.
So it's a system that, for local governments, works, Representative Hutton, according to Representative Hesselbein.
Well, again, I think we have to be careful when we're talking about that we care for and we're looking at impacting all workers, because roughly 20% to 25% of all construction workers in the state of Wisconsin are represented by some union affiliation. And it tends to favor those individuals that have that representation, which I am perfectly fine with. I think unions have their place and should thrive like all other entities in the state. The problem becomes when RFPs in this case are
requests for proposal
isolationist in terms of those companies and those employees that are represented from participating. In an essence, it does harm a significant labor pool in Wisconsin of those workers that aren't represented by, in this case, labor unions. I would agree with Representative Hasselbein. I think we should care about workers, but I don't think we should discriminate about those that we really prefer based on having some type of representation. I think we want to care for our neighbors, both to my left, who's a union representative worker, and those to my right, who are a non-union representative worker, to have equal opportunity to provide for their family, regardless of what those jobs are and regardless of where those jobs are.
So we even had
amendments for this bill last time that said we'd like to give preference to veterans, we'd like to give preferences to Wisconsin workers, and those were all rejected. So, I mean, we tried to work with this to make it for our neighbors in the state of Wisconsin, and that's not what this bill did.
Representative Hutton?
Sure, and again, I think we have a lot of legislation out there that we have strong bipartisan support for our veterans and opportunities we want for them to be able to come back and receive the training appropriate for them to reintegrate back into the workforce. This specific issue around PLAs really had very little to do, if anything, with individuals who have prior military service. It simply said, let's open the playing field because we have non-union and union members who both have past military background. We want all of those individuals who have those specific honors within our state to thrive, and project labor agreements didn't provide that umbrella coverage for all veterans, regardless of what firm they worked for and the type of work that they did within that vocational trade.
Representative Hasselbein, we focused in on this one particular example. Are there other examples where you pointed toward a bunch of different Republican legislation that you say overrode local control? What are other ones that have concerned you over the past few years?
Oh, boy, there are so many. Certainly this project labor agreements is one of the ones that I still hear about from people in my district that they're very upset about. It seems like every other day they're taking something away. I think Representative Hump, you were on the Waukesha County Board as well, weren't you?
That's correct.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, do you hear back home from, like, the Counties Association wondering when you're taking away local control from the unit of government you used to serve? Do people ask you about that?
No, I really don't. And Representative Hasselbein, I really don't see inconsistencies with where we've aligned counties and their roles within the various levels of state government. I mean, to some degree, county government is an extension of state government, and there's a lot of collaboration and needed to be relative to the function that we have at the state and at the county level. I've heard very little from the Counties Association or our county executive around any issues that we've looked at here in the state. In fact, I think they've seen us as a good partner for enabling collaboration, enabling more cooperation amongst counties, things that we've really led the charge on to ensure that those counties are functioning as efficiently as they possibly can be.
And I wanted to ask the legislation on minimum wage. We've seen this around the country, local governments setting a minimum wage higher than the state minimum. You're a co-sponsor of a bill, Representative Hutton, that I think had a public hearing this week. It would prevent that happening. Can you talk about why the state should be involved in preventing local governments from changing their minimum wage?
Sure. Well, again, I think it's another good case in point for where local decisions, in this case around labor wages, has a broader ripple effect across the state. And I think we've given the role and responsibility both at the federal and state level to set wage scales. And I think if you begin to look at individual municipalities trying to determine minimum wages for especially government projects, which is really what they're looking to do, you're putting, again, the employers and the employees of those firms that would look to perform those projects, whether they're new schools being built or revamping a city hall or constructing a library, you're putting those employers in a very difficult position of having to manage operations that are unique within each municipality and having to comply with, in this case, wage laws that are different, not only depending on the municipality, but also depending on the project. And it's very difficult as an employer to be able to manage an employee base and not have employees concerned about why am I being assigned to this project when it's one minimum wage law, when I would love to go work on this project because it's, quote, another 10 cents an hour based on that local municipality. Again, I think we're looking at how do we provide consistency for our employee and employer community to function well within our state.
And I want to bring Representative Hasselbein in on this one now. The minimum wage, a local government's ability to set a higher wage, especially in government projects. What's your take on this?
I absolutely think that local governments should be able to figure out what they need for a minimum wage. I think having a one-size-fits-all doesn't work for the state of Wisconsin because the needs in Waukesha are very different than Dane County, which is very different than Dunn or Pepin, and the average home isn't the same either, or rental, or you know, if they're renting, the rent unit prices are different. So I think those decisions are best made on a local level. It kind of makes me think of my daughter, who's a CNA, and she is working in Dane County, and she can go to different places and different nursing homes and try to get a job, and they're all paying different things based on their need and based on how much they're willing to pay her. But that's true. That same premise is true for the entire state of Wisconsin. And those people that live there know those communities. They know what's a fair minimum wage, and we should be letting them tell people what that should be, not coming from the state, because whether it's $10 an hour, $15 an hour, $12 an hour is very different in Dane County than it is in Rhinelander and other things as well. So I think local control is very important.
That's all the time we have. Representative Hasselbein, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being invited.
And Representative Hutton, thanks to you as well.
It was a pleasure to join you. Thank you for the discussion.
That was Democrat Diane Hasselbein and Republican Rob Hutton, both assembly representatives here in Wisconsin. They joined us earlier today to talk about the power local governments should or shouldn't have to override state law on things like wages, benefits, and worker protections. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we continue the conversation. Have you seen a lack of local decision-making power affect things in your community? When should the state override local laws? When should it keep its hands off? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're joined now by Jerry DeShane. He's Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, from the perspective of municipalities around the state, do you get a sense that people are thinking, hey, the state is maybe doing too much, maybe encroaching on our turf a little too much?
Absolutely, we do. It sort of ebbs and flows over history. Local governments have been frustrated by that, frankly, since statehood. Right now, I think we're going through a period where you're seeing a little bit more of it. Sometimes you see less, but right now you're seeing a little bit more.
And looking in the long term, right now it's often Republicans are being accused of doing this because they've been in control of the state government for a while. Is this something that only Republicans have done that bugs local governments, or have there been periods where Democrats have been not getting fans in local government?
Well, and I like both Representative Hutton and Representative Hesselberg are good friends of local government. But the reality is both parties take advantage of the fact that they get to set the rules in Madison. So whichever party happens to be in the majority is the party that tends to step on home rule. Those 100 bills that Representative Hesselbein mentioned, a fair number of them, as I recall, have a fair number of Democratic votes for them. So it cuts both ways. We don't blame it on one party or another.
So where do you think the line should be? What kind of test should there be before state lawmakers pass something that preempts a local ordinance?
Well, quite frankly, I think they ought to ask themselves the question of where can this particular problem best be resolved? It's a management axiom that you fix issues as close to the issue as possible. And that would mean giving local governments as much flexibility and ability to act as they possibly can have. Wisconsin passed what was called a Home Rule Amendment. It only applies to cities and villages back in 1922, thinking we would address this problem by letting cities and villages manage their own affairs. But quite frankly, that has been ignored.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Terry with us in Green Bay. Terry, hi. Terry, go ahead, Terry.
My apologies. I'm concerned, obviously, like anyone else, and a lot of local officials are. They're complaining that too much power is being removed from their hands and the decision-making process. There's already been 140 laws that have been passed that have taken away local control from folks. Most recently was changes to the conditional use permit, one of the most the pillars of local control. That basically the new law says that public testimony no longer can be used to deny somebody applying for a conditional use permit. That's ridiculous because locals are where they have should have be able to have a say what goes in their community or not.
Terry, thanks for the call. Jerry, is that something you've seen as a problem?
It is. And the conditional use permit bill that he references, although I should clarify, public testimony can be used. It just has to be fact-based. It can't be an opinion of a member of the public can't drive a decision for a conditional use permit. But what you hear in Terry's voice is what I hear on the phone from local government officials. And they can be conservative local government officials or liberal ones. They get very frustrated when they have to make a decision only to be told, oh, no, the state passed a law that says you can't do that.
Terry, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Willem on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. You know, in the past, it was said to me that the Republicans had stood for this principle that the government closest to the people is the best, and that would advocate for local control. And I think that, like in a township, I think the people, the residents of a township, have a right to determine what their township looks like, you know, both physically and what sort of things go on in that township. And many times the argument is for property rights, like in terms of like sand mining or things like that. But, you know, that's different than, you know, what color someone wants to paint their house. But if they want to put a mine into a township, that affects the property rights of all the other people. So that's a wider issue. And I think that Senator Tom Tiffany, who I think that also the same principle, follow the money, you see where the influence is coming from these outside mining companies, not local residents.
Willem, thanks for the call. We're running a little short on time. Jerry, do you see, in some cases, corporate money leading state government to override local laws?
Well, I'm not going to put a label on it like that, but I will say this. Big businesses are looking for uniformity to make their operations easier to manage, more efficient. And going to the state once for a law change is easier than going to every city and village hall.
Is it? And maybe there's a case to be made for that then. Business will work better in Wisconsin, as Representative Hutton was saying, if we have that one state law instead of a bunch of local ordinances.
Well, yes and no. But what the state can't do is take into account local geography. They can't take into account the immediate wishes of the neighbors and the citizens of that area. And that's why we've always had this axiom of the closer to the problem you are, the more likely you are to come up with a good fix for the problem. I understand the desire for a uniform set of standards, but that also runs into the wishes of the voting public.
And we'll leave it there for now. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Rob, always a pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That was Jerry DeShane. He's executive director for the Wisconsin League of Municipalities. We've been talking about the principle of local control in Wisconsin when the state government can override local regulations and ordinances at the city or town level, county or village level. We heard earlier from two state assembly representatives, Rob Hutton, a Republican, and Diane Hesselbein, a Democrat. And you could still share your thoughts on this issue, by the way. Is this a live issue where you live? You can let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Love to read what you have to say. Wisconsin continues its dominance of the competitive cooking scene. A while back, we talked to Jen Barney from Stoddard. She went on to win the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship. And last night, Chef Tori Miller from Madison came out on top in an episode of Food Network's Iron Chef Showdown. It took two stages. He beat a chef from Chicago. Sorry, neighbors. His winning dish included russet potatoes, sweet potatoes, chorizo, shiitake mushrooms, and a fried egg. And then he took on celebrity chef Bobby Flay. I've seen this guy on the show beat Bobby Flay, and he is hard to beat, at least, you know, based on what I've seen on that show. But Miller did it in a bison themed competition. So Miller, the Wisconsin chef's dishes included a bison carrot summer roll, bison meatballs, and a bison gnocchi, that pasta with cheddar. I'm assuming it was the cheddar from a Wisconsin chef that sealed the deal there. So we're not going to be winning any Super Bowls this year. Didn't get that national championship for football that we had a shot at before, you know, just a month ago or so. But we are still the champions of the cooking world. This is Central Time. We are the champions.